Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. With me this hour is a name I know is familiar to most of you, especially those folks who love public television, and that's Bill Moyers. Bill Moyers, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you here in the studio.
It's a delight to be with you, Mark.
Topic of conversation today is, of course, the series called Genesis, A Living Conversation. And it is about, of course, the first book of the Bible. We had Burton Vysotsky on, who wrote the book The Genesis of Ethics, which was, Burton and his groups were the inspiration for this series of Bill Moyers. How did you find Burton Vysotsky? What was the story of how you stumbled onto him and his group? Whether it was a stumble or not, I'm not sure, but
It came from reading the New York Times. A reporter from the New York Times had been up to sit in on Burt's Genesis seminar, which he'd been conducting at the Jewish Theological Seminary on the west side of New York for several years. And the New York Times reporter described it as the best conversation in New York. Mm-hmm. That intrigued my curiosity because I consider one of my beats in journalism is the world of ideas. So I thought, if that's a good conversation, there are ideas there. I called Burt, asked him if I could come. He said, come on. I went up, and what I heard was sparkling, rip-roaring conversation about some of the most basic ideas we face as human beings. And that's when I decided I had to do this on television.
Now, when you went there, different cultures and different spiritual perspectives approach the study of the Bible and the study of spiritual issues differently. Jews have always studied it for 2,000 years in this kind of Midrash discourse where you go at it about little nuances of the Bible, which is kind of what he set up. Was this your first kind of leap into that?
This was my first experience with Midrash. I grew up a Baptist in East Texas. I heard all of these stories in Sunday school. Our preachers preached sermons about them on Sundays. And then I did 4 years of graduate school, getting my Master of Divinity in seminary, studied Hebrew for 2 years. I was familiar with these stories. But we Baptists go at these stories, argue about them, of course, but we're always looking for a moral point. We're always looking for 3 points in a poem for a sermon. We were going to study the Bible for the answers that we needed. Midrash is where you go to get your answers questioned. The Jewish tradition is going at these ideas, trying to fill in the blanks of Scripture. What was in Isaac's mind when he was under his father's knife? What was Sarah thinking after having offered Hagar to her husband, as in fact Hagar was inside in bed with her husband? It was fascinating. The first session I went to, Mark, Robert Benton was there, the screenwriter of Kramer versus Kramer and Places of the Heart. And at one point, Burt Vysotsky asked him, whom would you cast as the femme fatale in the story of Potiphar and Potiphar's wife and Joseph? Potiphar was the captain of the Pharaoh's guards who had brought Joseph to the place of primacy in his home, made him his slave master. And Potiphar's wife lusted for Joseph. Joseph resisted her. Finally, because Joseph said no and ran from her, she reported to her husband, Potiphar, that Joseph had tried to rape her. Well, this angered Potiphar, who threw Joseph in prison, and the rest is history. So Burt Vysotsky says to Robert Benton, whom would you cast as the femme fatale, Meryl Streep or Glenn Close? And before Benton could answer, Nessa Rapoport, the novelist, said, no, Joseph is the femme fatale. And as Burt later said, you know, that's not only stunning insight, not only wicked humor, but it's stunning insight. It's that kind of discussion that was going on.
What to you is different about the nature of this communal study of the Bible that kind of takes place in the Jewish tradition that you are kind of really talking about in this series, that people like Chris Layton here at the Institute of Christian and Jewish Studies, who helped in this series, is trying to form here in Baltimore, the notion of the communal study of the Bible as opposed to this kind of individualized looking at the text by yourself, stuck in your little room with no dialogue going on? Is there a difference in the approach, what comes out?
Absolutely. When you're doing it alone, I'm not saying you can't get something out of it. We all do, but you're left to your own devices. The truth of the matter is, each of us has an experience with life and with the text that equips us to say something about the text that you might learn from. I mean, your own life's experiences, your experiences as a 20-year-old, a 30-year-old, will shed light on a story that I will learn from when I hear you talking about it. So that it's in the reading of the text together, the arguing, the interpreting, the debating, the questioning, the challenging, the amending, the requiring you, asking you for a second opinion, asking you to, wait a minute, what did you really mean by that? That suddenly these texts, which are so familiar, lose the scales of the habit that we approach them with and begin to take on a new life.
You know, when I talked to Burton Vysotsky about Genesis and his book, Genesis and the Genesis of Ethics, One of the things he talked about was that how he sees Genesis as a tale of just human history, the way human beings look at existence, about deeply flawed individuals, about dysfunctional families, that this is what he sees the Bible talking about. Now, if you were to say that 20, 30, 40 years ago, if I was to say that to the Rebbe I studied with as a kid, or you was to say that to the preacher you would talk to in your church in East Texas, I mean, they would have been stunned to hear that that's what Genesis is about.
They would. Some of them would still be stunned. In fact, they're wheeling in their chairs right now and saying, and marching on the station. I have no question about it. I couldn't have done this series 25 years ago, because you couldn't approach the Bible in a pluralistic way the way we are in this series. But America's changed. We're living in a new religious landscape today. When I went to New York in 1968, having left Washington, I was surprised as a boy from East Texas to find people riding the subway reading the Torah. I never in East Texas saw anybody reading the Torah. Then I was surprised to see people riding the subway reading the Bible in Spanish, mm-hmm. Puerto Ricans and others who'd come there. Today, when I ride the subway, I'm just as likely to see somebody reading the Quran because Islam is growing in influence in this country. So we have a new pluralistic society today, and it's possible to bring varieties of eyes and minds to bear on a story that 25, 30 years ago was considered exclusively the property of a certain people of faith.
It's interesting because you say Muslims, you know, it's an interesting fact that this country founded by men of the Episcopal faith for the most part, now members of people who are Muslims outnumber Episcopalians in America.
And they outnumber Presbyterians.
And they outnumber Presbyterians as well, that's right.
And in 4 to 5 to 7 years, it's possible that there will be more Muslims in America than Jews.
That's right.
Which is an interesting demographic change. Well, look, for 200 years, the religious discourse, as well as the political discourse in this country, was dominated by white males, Protestants of a culturally conservative European heritage.
Mm-hmm.
So that alternative voices, alternative visions of America, whether of the role of women or of the role of faith or of race, never reached the mainstream. That's not so today. Diane Eck, who's the great historian of religion at Harvard, says we can no longer talk of the American melting pot. We have to talk of the American mosaic, or even, to be a little more vernacular, the American tossed salad, because mm-hmm. this is what's happening. And in effect, that's been liberating for those of us who think religion plays a vital role in our heart, because it's one thing to talk about the Bible, the Torah, in my case, when I grew up, we Baptists talked only to Baptists about it. We didn't talk to Presbyterians about the Bible or to Methodists mm-hmm. or to United Church of Christ. We talked only to Baptists. Jews, I think, only talked to Jews about the Torah.
Absolutely.
That's all changed now. I mean, it's still valuable, intrinsically valuable for people of particular faith. But these stories, these ideas in Genesis and in the rest of the Bible concern us all in larger ways than simply parochial interpretation.
How do you find, and why do you find, that people can read the same word, people can read the same story, maybe from the same edition of the Bible, and find absolutely different meanings in the same story, whether it's Cain and Abel or the story of Joseph or whatever story they pick, and just come up with totally different interpretations using the same word?
When I worked at the White House under Lyndon Johnson, I asked a reporter just back from Vietnam, who's telling the truth out there? And he thought a moment and he said, everybody, because everybody sees what's happening through the lens of his own experience. That's true of life, and that's particularly true of religious and spiritual matters. Each of us arrives in the world with a totally different thumbprint, mm-hmm. fingerprint. And we apply that fingerprint to every experience we have. We see the world through the lens of our own experience. That's the explanation for it.
Bill Morris is my guest here this hour on the Mark Steiner Show. One of the things that really struck me in reading the book, your book, which was pulled out of the series, the conversations that took place with all the people that I want to talk about, I mean, how you found these people and who they were and why you picked them and the mix that you found. But there was something that really struck me. Over and over again during the different passages, I think Bert Vysotsky and others who spoke Hebrew would stand up and talk about what the Hebrew word meant. Let me just give you one example of what I'm talking about. That the Hebrew meaning is so very different than the English translation you find in most Bibles, even the English translation you find in the Hebrew Bibles. As example, Cain says in Hebrew, Gadol avoni miniso, my sin, my iniquity is too great to bear. The translation in a Protestant Bible was, my punishment is too great to bear. Now, that happened over and over again in this series of conversations. How can you even begin to have a conversation about the meaning of the words in the Bible if we don't even begin to agree what those words are?
Well, that's why for so long there's been such discord in our reading of the Bible. We can't agree on the basic meaning of the word. It's why we tried to have in all of these discussions a couple of people who were familiar with the language of the Bible, with the original of the Bible, so that a Bert could come in and say, well, this is what it means in the original. Then you can argue about what it means today because of what it meant in the original. But this is, of course, a conundrum in the study of the text over the centuries, the translations of them.
Yeah.
There's this wonderful change. You know, when Adam is referred to for the first time, I believe it's Adam, Adamah, mm-hmm. which in the Hebrew has the sense of being created from the earth, from nature. Then when Adam does this first love poem of a man to a woman, bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, Adam himself in the poem changes it from Adam, Adamah to Adam, Ish, which has more of a meaning of a personal relationship created for the other. And with the other, so that you begin to get the whole idea of Martin Buber's changing the relationship from I and it, I and nature, I and the world, the cosmology around me, to I and you, I and thou. It's the power of the slight shift.
Yeah, it's huge. It's
wonderful. I studied both Hebrew for 2 years, did not do well in Hebrew, did terrifically in Greek. Uh-huh. I had to have 5 years of Greek to mm-hmm. study for New Testament studies. And how the scripture would change for me by discovering not only the difference between English and classical Greek, but English and Aramaic, which is the Greek of the New Testament. So it always helped to have a Bert Bosofsky there to help guide us with a roadmap into the possible tributaries that flow out of the new meaning of a word as you hear it for the first time in Hebrew. I love, for example, have you had anybody here to talk? Have you had Everett Fox here to talk about his new Bible, The Shocking Bible?
No, have not. I mean, I know the work, but I have not.
It's not an easy book to read, but to have it read brings alive the music and the power, the resonance of the Hebrew language in a way so that while you don't grasp it rationally, you grasp it intuitively. And the Hebrew as spoken transforms the Bible, in the eyes of a Gentile at least, in a way that I could never have imagined.
And not just in the minds of a Gentile. I mean, I think that what happens here is that when you read, I was looking at the Bible I got when I was bar mitzvahed at 13 years old. And it was an English-Hebrew Bible that most young boys get when they get bar mitzvahed. And I was looking at Genesis, just thinking about the show and kind of looking through Genesis and realizing that, and I was starting to look up some of the texts that Bert referred to in terms of the Hebrew translation and what that really meant. And then I read the English translation in the Hebrew Bible, which wasn't even as close to what the original Hebrew was either. Mm-hmm. So that's what I started thinking about now. How can we begin to have this in-depth dialogue about what Genesis means when the ideas and how we translate them are so differently, that punishment can mean sin, and that freeing about my iniquity means that what I've done, I can't live with what I've done. These are two different meanings.
It transforms him from being somebody who's whining about the punishment to somebody who's burdened with guilt and who is troubled. A totally different picture. It makes you understand somewhat why perhaps, as we discuss in the series, God was willing to let Cain go, and he didn't require an eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. We have a fascinating discussion in the series on this because some people had a hard time. Oscar Huelas.
Yeah, he was really fascinating. The Puerto Rican man from New York, the writer.
He won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, Mambo Kings Play Love Songs.
Right.
Oscar, who was raised a Catholic, he has a hard time with the fact that God let this murderer go.
Right.
And Mary Gordon has a hard time with it because she says, you know, Cain had the opportunity for redemption. Cain could repent and enjoy a full life. Adam, Abel, was dead. And dead, she said, is dead. And she said, for me, this is the hopeless moment, the realization that purity of heart and innocence had nothing to do with Abel's fate. All Abel did in innocence was to bring an offering to the Lord. And for that, he lost his life. And she said, this is what makes it so hard for me to believe in God. Purity and innocence didn't save the Jews. Purity and innocence didn't save the Native Americans. Purity and innocence didn't save the Africans who were sold into slavery. So she said, what is it about us, the pure and the innocent, that calls us to be the first to go? And we have a really terrific discussion about this.
Now, I could go on with this forever, but let me let some folks in this conversation, or you and I will just go off and forget we actually have a call-in show here. Jason in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Hi. Moyers.
Yes.
Yes, I'm interested to hear your comments on how Genesis may be a metaphor for how we begin to explain or perhaps describe the world around us. It's not so much in a religious context, but more just a beginning for how we look at the world.
Well, for some people, it is a metaphor. For some people, it is a serious religious document. It is the revealed word of God. And that's the wonderful thing about our discussions. We have people in the seminar, in the programs, for whom the Bible is the living word of God. And we have people there who are skeptical, people who are not sure. But always the discussion, even among believers and non-believers, always the discussion is civil, even if passionate.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Jerry in Reisterstown, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Jerry.
I wanted to tell you how much I admire you, Mr. Moyers, and I've for many years for your work and you know all that.
Thank you.
I saw a painting a few years ago of Caravaggio. It's called The Sacrifice of Isaac. I don't know if you are familiar with it, but in the painting called The Sacrifice of Isaac, Isaac is terrified. His face is one of such dread and fear. He's about to be slaughtered. It's the angel sent down by the Lord staying the hand of Abraham as he has a knife close to the throat of Isaac. It's a fabulous painting in the fact that the fear is there, and it seems like Abraham, whose head is turned, still has a face of determination. There is a painting by Rembrandt that was painted probably 150 years later, somewhere in the 1600s, of which Isaac has a face of calm resolve, as if he's saying, "Well, whatever will be. If I gotta die, I gotta die." In other words, it's two entirely interpretations in this case. I remember years ago, infuriating my Rebbe in my Hebrew school hall called Cheder, when I did a painting of the flood, and I showed innocent men, women, and children being just totally wiped out and washed out. I showed babies being drowned and everything else by the
mm-hmm.
He got infuriated, but I said, "Well, this is my opinion as to what I believe, you know, religion is." So the question I wanted to ask is: isn't basically a good deal of this? I would imagine the Bible, Genesis, was a log, you know, kept from various mm-hmm. people. But wasn't it an interpretation, an opinion, rather than anything really based on fact?
I can't answer that question. I mean, I have to assume that somebody selected these stories because they help Jews understand how they came to be chosen, but to be God's chosen people. It's hard to say what was in the mind of any redactor or any editor. By the way, Mark, who is my biblical consultant here, just reached over and opened my book on Genesis to page 235, and there is Caravaggio's Sacrifice of Isaac. Interesting point, Jerry. When I was raised a Baptist, a Christian, and for me it was the sacrifice of Isaac. It didn't occur to me actually until these discussions that the Jews don't refer to the sacrifice of Isaac. They call it the binding of Isaac because
yes.
Isaac wasn't sacrificed.
Right.
And in fact, one of the interesting interpretations in the discussion that grew up in our taping was that perhaps the angel, perhaps this whole story is God's way of saying to the Jewish people, it's time to end child sacrifice, which was a rather pervasive pagan custom of the time. And that maybe all of this was an effort to drive home the point that child sacrifice is unacceptable to this one God. But the truth of the matter is, I think I take your side and not the other fellows, because I believe this is all open to the best interpretation of the most informed judgment we can individually make about it. And then together try to learn different insights that might help us grow our own faith in a more healthy and mature way.
Thank you, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Great.
Thanks for your call, Jerry. Appreciate you calling. Before we go back to the phones here, and Eric, you're the next up, so don't hang up. We're going to come right to your call. What Jerry brought up made me think of something else. We were talking before we went on the air about Joseph Campbell and his entire work on myth and the thing you did with him and this incredible body of work he created. But one of the things that talked about to me, when I thought about that in terms of this new work you're doing on Genesis, is that Genesis is also about myth. But yet, we seem to want to treat it as something more divine than the other myths. Do you know what I'm saying? And that and that these are also allegories. And so many of the things that we see in Genesis are things that we find in other people's myths that came before the Hebrews even, that we know they grew out of something concrete. And just as you said, maybe that story about Isaac came out as a, because they wanted to deal with the issue of child sacrifice.
Well, remember that, as I say in the introduction to my book, that these ideas, the faith, says the New Interpreter's Bible, which is my favorite commentary, was not fundamentally an idea, but an embodiment, a way of life. The language and experience of faith in the Torah, the Old Testament, the Bible, thus remain concrete and personal. It does not dissolve into myth, into some mystical world of the gods that suppresses the human or the natural, or some religious world far removed from the secular sphere. By and large, the world reflected in these stories is ordinary, everyday, and familiar, filled with the surprises and joys, the sufferings and the troubles, etc. That's what separates these stories from the kinds of myths that Joe Campbell was talking about, or the myths of the Greeks and the Romans that were about gods and about figures from the planets. These are stories about real people. And what I think gives the Bible, that's Genesis, its power today, is that they're starkly human stories. And when you read them, you don't think mythologically. You think of Abraham as a very flawed man. In fact, Abraham was flawed. We had a fascinating discussion the other day in Minneapolis when I was doing a lecture there, that Abraham was so flawed that he hid behind the skirts of his own wife in order to save his life. And people got off into that, into thinking, well, you know, if Abraham was flawed and yet was the instrument for the children of Israel becoming a nation, a people, then maybe it's all right that our president of the United States is a flawed man. 56% of the people say they don't think Bill Clinton has the character or the honor that he ought to have, but they're going to vote for him.
That's right.
And there's something about these stories that are so that is so realistically human that we don't tend to go off into mythology the way we did in the Campbell series.
I want to go off to the phones now, but after the phones, I want to remember to come back to something that had a conversation on Sunday about the show I was about to do with a friend of mine who is a Lakota man, and his questions about Genesis. And I said, let me think about things. We're going to raise this on the show. So when we come, let's go back to the phones here. It was interesting. Eric in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was just listening to your conversation about how different translations, how can we agree on the meaning?
Yeah.
And it reminded me of a seminar I had on Reformation history at one point, where the Mennonites, to counter claims that the Catholics, who had much more learning on their side and also claimed that their translation was sanctified by the Holy Spirit over this long tradition, said, well, actually, all translations are sanctified by the Holy Spirit, and they're giving distinct revelations for each period. I don't know. I thought it just would shed a different light on things.
That's a very interesting point. Remember, yeah. I said earlier, I was raised a Baptist. We Baptists believe in what we call the priesthood of the believer. That is, you know, Luther split off from the church, and then Mennonites and others split off from Luther. And
right.
And our interpretation is that we try to inform ourselves as well as we can. We try to read and talk and study. But in the end, it's the relationship between me and God that determines our own judgment about these matters, and that we're responsible, we're accountable to God for the best informed but personal decision that we can make. In fact, I think the real cultural war in the next 25 years is going to be not between Hollywood and everyone else, but it's going to be between people who feel sort of like the New Age spirituality, that experience is the only guide I need, and everyone else who still, in a religious framework, looks to tradition and authority, orthodoxy, and the text. I think that's where the conflict's going to become in the world of religion. But there's really nothing new about that. From the very beginning, this has been part of the reason religion has become is so divisive, that individuals are left to their own devices.
And that, to me, is – and thanks for your call, Eric. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. But that, to me, is kind of the most important part of the work that you're doing in this series, is if a dialogue, a conversation can take place between evangelicals and Catholics and Orthodox Jews and Reformed Jews and people of the Islamic faith and Buddhists and people of the Native American faith about what these issues mean, that creates the kind of dialogue that in disagreement you find common ground that maybe ends some of the verbal bloodshed that is let out in this country.
See, I don't think you would ever convince me that your way of seeing it is the right way.
Right.
But if I understand what you see and why you see it, then I am able to live more civilly with you. If we stop trying to impose or coerce or turn away from somebody simply because he or she doesn't take our view of work, but we do understand. In the 50s, we had these ecumenical dialogues, which really were sort of phony protocols in which we would express interest in your religion and then say, well, that's very nice. You know, we tipped our hat to the other faith without knowing what was in the mind of the person underneath that hat. Now, I want to know what is in your mind, not just tip my hat in respect to you. I want to know what's in your mind. I will probably not agree with you, but if I know where you're coming from, if I know what you think, A, I might learn something, and B, I might not feel as alien or as foreign or as superior to you as I would otherwise.
And on our way to break, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of services, MeQ Baltimore's credit union has been helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. So when you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.ecu.com. Or at steinershow.org is MeQ Baltimore Credit Union's banner.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, sitting here with Bill Moyers. Eric, in your car, you're on the air.
Yes. How you doing, Mark?
Good, Eric. How are you?
All right.
Good.
Nice to hear from you as well, Mr. Moyers.
Thank you, sir.
I deeply admired your work with Joseph Campbell, and also as well as the series The Power of the Word.
Right. That's my series on poetry.
Right.
Yes, that doesn't get enough airtime as far as I'm concerned in this area. But anyway, I have a comment. It seems that biblical scripture has become overwhelmingly interpreted by Europeans, and yet the Bible was primarily written and created by non-Europeans. I would like to hear you address that. Also, anthropologically speaking, Europeans are a post-Aboriginal people. And Europeans and Asians are mainly post-Aboriginal people, and non-European and non-Asian primarily are Aboriginal people. And just as I, in this country, I'm finding that there are vast differences in the characteristics of non-European people and European people.
Okay.
And I think it has a lot to do with how we see things and how we our perceptions go beyond, you know, the cultures that we share.
Eric, I just want to jump in because you're breaking up a little bit, so if you can get to the point of the question, we can talk about it because you're breaking up. I don't want you to lose your thought there. Go ahead.
Well, I would just like to know what Mr. Moore, if he has ever thought about addressing those issues. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eric.
The exciting thing about biblical studies today is that it is now open to so many voices and minds and perceptions that were for so long sort of marginalized. As I said earlier, this has been mainly the turf of the white, male, Protestant, culturally conservative European. But in our series, in the book, in the television series, we have some wonderful African-Americans who are bringing some fresh and powerful insights. P.K. McCreary is a woman from Houston who's a storyteller. She's a lay woman. She's not ordained. She did a fascinating book a few years ago called Black Bible Chronicles, from Genesis to the Promised Land. It was a version of the Old Testament aimed at black kids in the street. She said, you know, this wonderfully powerful, resonating cadence of King James doesn't reach the kids in the streets. Well, I want to put Genesis and the great stories of the Bible into language that street kids can understand. She worked very hard on it, and that's a very important contribution to black culture in this country. Renita Weems, a marvelous African-American ordained woman who started out as a stockbroker and wound up doing a Ph.D. in philosophy, teaches at Vanderbilt. She's here. Samuel Proctor, the former pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church, the big Baptist church in Harlem, is in here. Charles Johnson, who won the National Book Award for Middle Passages, a story about slavery, is a participant in the first program on Cain and Abel. So we have a practicing Buddhist. We have a Hindu novelist, Bharati Mukherjee, who brings some perspective to it. We have a lot of perspectives in the series that I think Eric, will show you that biblical studies is now opening up in a marvelous new way.
It'd be also be interesting when what Eric was saying leads me to what the conversation I had this weekend about Genesis with this Lakota friend of mine, and he out when I was in California this weekend, and he was saying, look, we have absolutely different visions of how the world works, of what makes us move the way we move as human beings. Our vision of Native people and the vision of most other people on the planet is very different. And he said, look, and we were talking about the Genesis thing, he said, look at the story that says you're here to subdue the earth. Look at the story that says Eve came from Adam. And look at our stories that say we came from the earth or a part of the earth, not here to subdue it, but to live with it. That most of our stories, this is the Lakota man talking, most of our stories start with the mother, not with the father, as being the birth giver to humanity. And how differently we look at it, and what that says to this interpretation of what we see about Genesis.
And Western culture has, while it has benefited from the its own sacred texts, has paid a heavy price for being deaf to the views of other cultures that celebrate a different view of creation and the earth. And the Native American story is a powerful story. In fact, there are several stories in the Native American culture about creation. Every culture has a story of creation, and they bear some remarkable similarities, yeah. Even though they do diverge. So it makes you wonder whether a story began one place and then was dispersed culturally throughout the world, or whether deep in the subterranean subconscious of every individual, there is a certain basic need to understand how this all happened. In fact, there are two stories of creation in the first book of Genesis. There's one where humanity, man and woman, are created at the same time mm-hmm. by the Creator. And then there's a few verses later, there's another one where woman is taken from the rib of man. And the latter has created a great bias in cultural attitudes toward women for a long time. We're only now beginning to come to terms with that story, primarily through the work of some very important feminist theologians. The problem is when any one of these stories gets translated into the cultural orthodoxy by which everyone is measured, then it becomes coercive and pervasive and intimidating, instead of being a way of beginning a discussion to see how we might differ on that same story. So I think, again, I'm encouraged by the fact that we can do this kind of series now, have this kind of discussion on radio.
Absolutely.
And acknowledge that Native Americans and others, Asians and others, have different ways of seeing creation, humanity, sin, redemption, and life, and yet we can all learn from each other.
And what I also learned from this, just reading the book, is that when you talk about Adam and Eve, is that the Hebrew translation is not necessarily the rib, but coming from the side.
The side.
A piece of, as if it was almost that man and woman were the same and they just separated into man and woman as Adam and Eve.
When I first went to the great cathedral in Chartres, I was a young man, and I turned the corner and there was a sculpture so stunning it stopped me in my tracks. Adam, the first human, is depicted as emerging from the side of God's head.
Mm-hmm.
God is literally thinking us into existence. I remember standing there overwhelmed by that idea and thinking, if this were our origin from the mind of God, then we have minds we must use to think for ourselves, to argue among ourselves, to debate with each other what it means to be made in the image of God. I cannot believe that the Creator intended for us to have this incredible faculty of intelligence and not use it even to challenge
Absolutely.
The Creator.
It makes me think of the Manischewitz, who was the rabbi who taught me when I was a kid. In my house, he said, he always taught from the Bible that God was not a figure or a form. You could not picture it, and that it would take any and every form. And so when you say it's in our image, it means we are everything and everything is. That was how he interpreted it. It was an interesting man. And I'm sorry I can't read my writing, but I know you're from Hampstead, so you're on the air. Tell us your name.
Hi, this is Brian. How
Brian, I'm sorry. I couldn't read what I wrote down. I apologize. Go ahead.
No problem. Hi, Mr. Moyers. I just want to thank you for all the wonderful work you do, especially most recently I saw your show on the disparity in the educational system in America. It was very powerful.
Thank you. I'm glad you watched that.
It was wonderful. I actually have your book, and I was reading in it about the fall of man, or the actual the differences in the Christian tradition and the Jewish tradition on how they view the fall of man. And I was wondering if you can go into it, especially when it talks about Eve eating the apple, and the Jewish version of that as gaining knowledge and freedom, and the Christian version of that as where that is the point where man has fallen. And I thought that was very interesting. And I was wondering if you can go into that a little bit.
Well, this is
thank
one
you,
of
Brian.
The thank you. This is one of the better discussions in the series because it proved eye opening to a lot of people there. I've always felt that, I guess perhaps there's a Jewish part of me that always felt that Eve got a bum rap. That when you come down to it, what she saw in that apple was beauty. It was a beautiful piece of fruit. Pleasure. It was delicious to eat. And knowledge. And out of this deep-seated curiosity, a desire for beauty, pleasure, and knowledge, she reached for it. And for that, she received what in the Bible is an eternal punishment. And I always thought, what's wrong with wanting pleasure, beauty, and knowledge? And I'm on Eve's side in that. Although there must be something, as we discuss in the series, there must be something there about boundaries, something there about overreaching. I don't know the answer to your question. What was the sin? This is one of the puzzling conundrums to me of the biblical story. What was the sin that was so offensive to God that the storyteller issued this punishment, this penalty on the woman who wanted beauty, pleasure, and knowledge?
It's a fascinating piece. I mean, that discussion in the book, in that first section, is just one of the most powerful things I've ever read in my life. It made me begin to think about that question, because I was so easy in the recent past to begin to think, to slough it all off as this myth saying that, you know, that this is condescending to women. The Bible supports slavery. It supports as a former civil rights worker, I remember segregationists always pointing to the parts of the Bible saying, the slavery is in the Bible. It is right. And after I read the Bible, I went, they're right. It is in there. It does say you can have slaves. But then it's under the word. And in between the words you have to read.
I think one of the reasons that people are resonating to this kind of discussion so much is that there is a weariness in the land with the argument, you know, the God of my cause, the God of my country, the God of my side, the God of my ideology.
Right.
We've had so much talk the last 20 years from the right wing claiming that God says this or God wants that, that, you know, religion in effect has become, well, here in Washington, I mean, in the nation's capital, and over in this area too, I think religion has become another interest group, like the National Association of Manufacturing or the National Rifle Association, and Moses and Jesus are lobbyists in their Gucci's prowling Congress advocating a tax break, and we have to move beyond that. The conversation of democracy and religion in democracy does not belong exclusively to the radical right. They have a right to say what they want to, but all these other voices need to be heard, too.
And I would say it belongs to all the voices, right, left, in the middle, and those who don't even put themselves in those categories. Anne and Royston, you're on the air.
Oh, yes. I'd like to comment on the gentleman's statement that the Bible was seen from a European perspective. And like Mr. Moyers to speak to this. At the time the Bible was written, that was part of the Roman Empire. They didn't think in terms of European and Asian. The Roman Empire extended from the Euphrates up until London. They didn't think in terms of European. And another comment, if you look at figures of the Nativity drawn by Orientals, the Christ child and Mary and Joseph are Orientals. Black people draw them as black people. Mexicans draw them as Mexicans. I'd like to hear Mr. Moyer's comment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, truth is that when these stories were first told and first written down, they were reflecting very particular cultures that did not refer to themselves as Middle Eastern or Far Western or whatever, or Near Eastern. These were written, these grew out of a culture, an apparently Semitic culture, of a group of people trying to explain who they were as a people and how they came together as a people. It was later, as the news traveled, as the people themselves traveled through different parts of that then-known world, that other accretions were added, other insights came. Mm-hmm. And we don't really know who wrote these stories. I mean, scholars debate this all the time about the J document and the P document and which part of the Genesis belongs to them. Then, of course, as Christianity came along and branched off from Judaism and became an evangelistic, proselytizing force moving through the Greco-Roman world, it began to add, it began to syncretize from elements of those cultures, so that Paul, the apostle who is so powerfully influential in the New Testament, you find a little bit of Greek, a little bit of Roman influence in him. The Gospel of John, some people think, is an almost is a distinctly Greek way of seeing the world. These stories, and all religions get syncretized over time. They get added to as they go mm-hmm. through their nomadic and expansionary phases.
And I think that sometimes when people talk about the Bible and Christianity being European, we talk about it because the embodiment of that in the modern world, because of the power of modern technology and industry and the power of Europe in colonizing the world and developing the world the way it has been done by primarily white Europeans. Yeah. So then you get the notion that it is a European document when it's not. It's the interpretation we've been living with for 500 years, though.
And somehow we have to move beyond that, because power of these stories is not who wrote them, or
right.
not how they got syncretized over time, or amended and metamorphosed over time. The power is in saying, what do these stories have to say to us today? I mean, the starkly human side of these stories makes them also very relevant today in our time. I mean, the story of Abraham, surrogate parenting, and the story of sibling rivalry and Cain and Abel. I was getting ready to start this series and book tour, and I was with my grandkids in Minneapolis, 1-4 and 1-2, and they're lovely children. I mean, it's nice to have the prettiest grandchildren in the world. You have to accept second best sometimes. But anyway, it was Sunday before we were in Minneapolis where my kids live, and my little 4-year-old sweet child who almost didn't make it. He had a very difficult birth, one lung and all of that. Mm. And that's sort of somehow made him more tender mm-hmm. than most children I know at age 4. He came in one morning, Sunday morning. I was having coffee, reading the paper, and his little brother, 2 years old, was there. And Henry just walks in and says, "I'm going to kill you, Thomas."
Whoa.
Now, I can assure you he didn't hear that in that family.
Right.
He doesn't watch television. They don't let him to watch television. He doesn't read yet. Where did it come from? Where does a 4-year-old say to a 2-year-old? And instantly, because I was on the eve of this trip, I thought of Cain and Abel.
Uh-huh.
You know, somehow, one of those parents had one of my son or my daughter-in-law had somehow tended to favor Thomas the night before, or Saturday, or earlier that morning in their bedroom, over Henry, and something rose in Henry to cause him to say, out of jealousy, "I'm going to kill you, Thomas." Now, he didn't mean it. But the word was there, something deep inside. And you go back and read Cain and Abel, and it makes you wonder. Here's God playing favorites. Both brothers brought an offering to the Lord. And the Lord favored the offering of the younger over the elder. And the humiliation and the elevation of the younger brought the humiliation of the older, and he killed his brother. It makes you wonder about, unintentionally even, playing favorites as a parent and the risks that are involved in negotiating the relationships between yourself and your children. I mean, these stories are very real if you look at them this way, whether or not they pass through European culture or whether or not...
That's the most unimportant part of it. I think one of the problems that people who come from progressive perspective, sometimes the mistake they make is in trashing that and in belittling what came out of Europe, rather than opening the door for all of it to be a piece of it. You don't have to belittle what was here originally in terms of the interpretation. I think that's a mistake many folks make, which creates dissension rather than dialogue.
One of Joseph Campbell's favorite stories was of the trickster god in an African tribe, and this god was so so playful toward and perhaps even so malicious toward the villagers that this god would walk down the street with his hat painted blue on one side and red on the other, and the moment he'd pass through the town, somebody on one side of the street would say, "Did you see that god with the red hat?" "What do you mean, red hat? That was a blue hat." "No, you SOB, it was a..." And then here they would go. This tale from Africa, this story that made some sense to those people, says something to me today as well,
mm-hmm.
whether it's from Africa or Asia.
Bill Moyers is here with us. Oh, and Andrew, in your car, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I didn't know I was going to get on.
Well, you got on. Yep. Go ahead, Andrew.
Mr. Morris, first of all, I wanted to say I've grown up with you. I remember you from CBS. I've always enjoyed watching you. It's a pleasure to hear you.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, listening to what you were saying, you mentioned the J and the P text, and it's been a while since I've read any of that. But, you know, it strikes me that having the two creation narratives back-to-back in Genesis 1 and 2 like that suggests that the authors, or whoever it was that put this text together, desired a dialogue within the faith. I mean, we've been talking about interfaith dialogue and how we approach each other's traditions, but you know that suggests to me that they were trying to reach out to the truth that developed within their own religion. And I just wanted to respond to one thing that Anne had mentioned. She stated at the time the Bible was written, I think the thing people overlook is that the Bible was not written at one time. It was a growing, living document that came into being over time. And sometimes, for instance, with the book of Daniel, the authors played with history and with time and tried to suggest that a text was written at a time other than when it actually was. I'd be interested in your comments on that, but that's all I have.
Thank you, Andrew. Glad you got through.
I think very simply, very quickly, that's a very legitimate idea, a very legitimate interpretation that these people included these two stories because they couldn't agree on which one was more valid. So they put them both in, and it created a dialogue within the community of faith in the Jewish people at that time. And the Bible is a living, growing interpretation.
And that kind of leads me into it, as we move into the end of the hour here, I think it's important to kind of talk about one of the reasons you did and created this series, beyond just making a television series and a book, is your idea of what should go on once the tube is cut off, which I think makes it a living conversation.
Yeah. In public television, I think we should disengage ourselves from the Nielsen meter, because the number of people who watch is not nearly as important as what people do who watch. And what we're hoping with this series and what the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies is doing so powerfully here in the Baltimore area is to have people watch the series together and then discuss it. Let it play out in your own lives, in your own conversation. Bring a group of people from your own congregation and other congregations, or if you're not a religiously affiliated person, bring your friends and neighbors and look at these series and then discuss it. One of the books, we have the big book with the whole transcripts in it, but we also have a small book, a resource guide, which the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies here in Baltimore helped us to do, that really is a guide for how to conduct your own dialogue, how to organize and what to talk about and how to listen to the series and then what questions to ask as you come out of the series. So what we're hoping is that the real impact of this series is not when it airs. It's what happens the next morning in the carpool, around the water cooler, at the coffee break, at lunch, and on Mark Steiner's 2 hours of radio.
Well, we'll try to continue the dialogue here as much as we can. Bill Moyers, thanks so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Mark.
Interesting conversation. Thanks so much. Welcome to Just Words, the stories of working people in our community. This is the hospital room of Kiana Christian Cannon, a 14-year-old honor roll student at Calverton Middle School.
Kiana was coming home from school. She gets out at 3. She comes in, take her books, put them on the bed or whatever, go back out and go up to the same school to pick her younger brother up. This particular day, she never made it. She never made it to that school because she was interrupted by gunfire.
That's her mother, Sheila Christian Cannon. Her daughter was caught in the crossfire of a fight between possible gang members. The neighborhood rumor is that a 12-year-old boy pulled the trigger. Kiana's at shock trauma, and she won't be leaving for a while.
According to what the doctors say to us on a daily basis, everything he says is long term. It's going to be months.
The bullet ripped through Kiana's abdomen, damaging her liver, bowels, and kidneys. Doctors had to remove her gallbladder. Her pancreas is leaking. She's in constant pain, physical and emotional.
I don't feel too good because I can't see all my friends and finish school like I wanted to.
The entire family is feeling the trauma of what happened to Kiana, and they worry over what happens next.
I mean, it does wear you out to stay in this hospital, night and day, not knowing what a condition gonna be. My daughter often tells me how afraid she is. She told us the second day that she could talk, that she never wants to go back there. Now, what am I to do as a mother? You know, to get her from the neighborhood. I can't just literally take her out and move her, you know what I mean? What am I supposed to do with my child? And making things impossible. That's what parents are supposed to do. We're supposed to make things possible for our children. So now I'm caught up in a position where I can't do that.
Kiana's father was granted an emergency 2-week leave from his job, but will soon have to return. Her mother has placed her home business on hold. With a long hospital stay certain, money is beginning to become a problem. There are other children in the family, two of them younger than Kiana, and they need to be cared for as well. This whole family has stepped into a nightmare. And for what? Battles over gang turf? Because a 12-year-old boy thought so little of life that he could do something like this? Whatever the reason, the guns were on the street.
The bullets don't have any names on them. Guns just in the air, it shouldn't be. Anybody could be outside. Anything. Anybody. Older person, younger person, middle-aged person, anybody. So where are we? Caught in catch-22 again. My child injured, their child may go away, may not go away. I tell you, circumstances of the day.
Just Words is a production of the Center for Emerging Media, produced by Jessica Phillips through a grant from OSI Baltimore, investing in solutions to Baltimore's toughest problems with audacious thinking for lasting change. On the web at osi-baltimore.org. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagan. Our engineer is Andrea Melton, and our intern is Morgan State senior Michael Dixon. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Please send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. The podcast is Steiner Show, and share it with your friends. Visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. For your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.